Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, can dogs sniff out COVID-19? And what's the correct way to wear a face mask? But up front, Pennsylvanians living with a disability or autism face hardships during the course of everyday life, social challenges, health concerns, and finding adequate care. Those difficulties are increased a whole lot during the coronavirus pandemic. About 80% have a pre-existing health condition that makes them more susceptible to the illness. But stay-at-home and shutdown orders have left many without support they normally would get. Advocates say support organizations are facing a financial catastrophe due to the pandemic, and the situation is going largely unnoticed. Joining us during this segment of today's program is Mark Davis, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Advocacy and Resources for Autism and Intellectual Disability Provider Association, or PAR. Mr. Davis, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here.
Also joining us is Kathy McHale, President and CEO of SPIN, Special People in the Northeast in Philadelphia. Ms. McHale, good to hear
good morning,
you this morning.
Scott.
I was about to say good to see you this morning, but good to hear you this morning.
Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mark Davis, let me start with you. What are some of the challenges that those living with an intellectual disability or autism are facing during this pandemic?
Well, that's a good question, Scott. I think it would be helpful to speak a little bit about our system. We have 50,000 Pennsylvanians with intellectual disability or autism. We call it IDA, served by about 55,000 direct support professionals, or DSPs. People that we serve have needs that range from fairly simple needs of maybe balancing their checkbook or helping them with their groceries or with their setting their menu, to folks with extremely complex needs who have needs 24/7, maybe on have administered medications through G&J tubes, who have needs with mobility where they need to be helped from the bed to the wheelchair or to another mobility device. Folks have, you know, anything, you know, Down syndrome, autism. Those are the folks that our folks work with. And many people with intellectual disability or autism rely on DSPs, many for their very lives. And DSPs really are doing very intimate and personal work, and we believe are essential frontline healthcare workers. And prior to COVID-19 pandemic, our service system was already under massive stress. We had 31% staff turnover. We had about 1 out of 5 direct support professional positions being open. And then the pandemic hit. And so you can imagine we had this system that was already challenged and struggling. And then we were hit with a pandemic. And we, according to the governor's order, we needed to shut down, which we supported and we actually suggested, suspending non-essential services in the community to comply both with the governor's order, but also to help the people and protect the folks that we serve and mitigate the spread of COVID-19. So we completely support that and agree with it for folks. But then you can imagine if someone has an intellectual disability and may have difficulty with really comprehending why they can't see their parents, why they can't go to work, why they can't go to the day program, why they can't see their friends, why they can't go to the grocery store. And that creates a lot of stress just among all of us, right? But you can imagine also somebody with an intellectual disability or with autism. Folks with IDA tend to be get comfort from routines and get comfort from the predictability of their lives. And between the 31% staff turnover, 20% open positions, the unpredictability and unnatural, if you will, and unprecedented nature of this pandemic, they really are struggling. And as you said, you know, over 80% of folks with intellectual disability or autism have 2 or more chronic conditions as defined by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So these are chronic conditions that we're not talking about a chronic cough. These are serious chronic conditions that place them at risk for significant COVID-19 complications and for contraction of the disorder. So they're out of the box, out of the gate. They're at a higher risk. They have challenges with understanding what's going on, creates more stress in their lives, and then we're really struggling with getting staff. We have staff whose families now are saying, you know, I love you, and I know you love your work, and you love working with people with disabilities, but you're putting our family at risk by coming in and out of that environment and with other staff and other people, and these people with disabilities, they're really scared. So we've got some staff members who are actually living in hotels. We have staff members that have felt so committed to the work that they're literally moving in, you know, staying with someone with who is COVID-19 positive for the two-week period they need to self-quarantine and provide assistance. But think about the toll that takes on them and their family members, as well as, you know, for the organization. That's 128 hours of overtime every week. That's extremely costly. And I can get into the costs and the surveys that have shown the tremendous cost and why we think we're such in dire strait right now. But I think that's a good way to stop in terms of how they're affected.
Yeah, you provided some really good context there, but I want to talk about two things that you mentioned first. You mentioned that turnover rate, and you talked about those unfilled positions. And that seems to go back to a lack of funding. And I know that that's one of the things that you're asking for of the state. But give us a sense of, even before the pandemic, of how your organizations were lacking money.
Great question, Scott. We have a single payer, so we're a single payer system. So all of our funding, virtually almost 100% of our funding, comes from the state and the federal government through Medicaid. So we don't have an option of raising a price or of doing anything like that, because we are completely funded and under their control, so to speak. They also pretty much control our expenses. They give us the requirements by which we have to follow. We are highly regulated. You know, we work with very vulnerable people. So I understand the regulation, but we are highly regulated both in terms of income and expense. So they have actually calculated in the methodology for our rate calculation that the DSPs, our direct support professionals, will make $13 an hour. We're actually averaging $13.20 an hour. So our members are doing a little better with getting people more money. But at $13 an hour, it's hard to imagine someone putting their life at risk for that. And we've had a significant issue with maintaining people in these jobs. When you think about the work that they're doing, you know, they're doing, again, very intimate, very personal work, preparing meals, administering medications through G&J tubes and food, soothing, you know, the unease created by uncertainty and isolation with this disorder. They're helping people with mobility. They're helping them get out of bed and move around. They're helping them get dressed. They're helping them go to the bathroom. They're helping them just through this emergency. And obviously, you know, when we talked about it beforehand, about the lack of funding creating this problem, inadequate funding creating this problem, so low-wage workers already, you can imagine there's no social distancing in the work that we do. And you throw in a pandemic, and it's just, we've got some folks that are reporting that their vacancy, their open position rates are actually doubling now because of this. So absolutely, before this, we were not in a good position because of the lack of funding, and now it's just been magnified through the pandemic.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment, but Kathy McHale, president and CEO of SPIN, which is Special People in the Northeast in Philadelphia, you have probably one of the most extensive services that you provide of anywhere in the state. Now, I'm just making an assumption here because I see you have pre-K, a lot of other services that you're offering to the intellectually disabled and those who have autism. But give me a sense of what it's like right now. I mean, you don't have students coming in. What can you do?
Yeah, and I just want to say SPIN is not entirely unique in that regard. There's many provider organizations that are very comprehensive. But you are right. The challenge is pervasive. It has been very difficult for families, for staff, for the individuals that we support. And many of the people that SPIN supports are, you know, home with their families. So it's taking a toll on the families. And although we are doing a great deal of remote work with the families and the children and the adults, and that has helped a lot, it has still, you know, been difficult for families. And then we also have 255 individuals that we support residentially in the essential work that we do, supporting people on a 24/7 basis. And that is where we have the direct support professionals working every day as essential frontline workers. So there's a great role that this has taken on people, on the people that we support, on their families. And then there's also a great financial toll as well.
Let's take a phone call from Robert in Pocono Lake. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to make a point that what you're paying these people, these direct people, basically you're saying you're paying them the same amount of money to say, take care of my son, make sure he's going to be safe and taken care of. And you're paying them the same amount of money as you say, make sure you put American cheese on my burger and make sure that it's got pickles. And I think that that's wrong, because I think that the people that are these direct care people should be paid more money. And I think that, by the way, I applaud you. I heard Governor Ridge on your show last week. I applaud Governor Ridge, and I think that this Governor Wolf has to really do something about these direct care people to take who take put their lives on the line every day.
Robert, thank you very much for your call. Mark, what about that? I mean, I think that you made the point that $13.20 an hour is not a whole lot. What do you say to Robert and calling for higher pay?
I want to have Robert talk to some legislators for us. That's exactly what we're looking for, Robert. I appreciate your passion. I feel the same way. It wakes me up at night. You know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we have members now that are having to pay 10 to 20% premiums just to get people to come into work, and they're paying double time to staff to work with someone with COVID-19, and they have no funds to go to this. Our study showed that our members have 2.9 days on average cash on hand, that our revenue and expenses have been impacted to the tune of almost 28%. So at a time when we're just getting crushed by this pandemic and we've got folks that are already paid not enough, it's just really creating a disturbing scenario for us. And I couldn't agree with Robert more.
And I know you had a press conference last week. One of the things that came out of that is that you said that this is something that is going largely unnoticed. What do you mean by that?
Well, we just don't see ourselves in the conversation a lot of time. I mean, there has been COVID-19 relief for hospitals and other healthcare providers, which we support, right? We're not absolutely, but there just is not a conversation. The governor has yet to declare our DSPs as essential healthcare workers. I mean, how can they not be essential healthcare workers when if they don't show up for work, someone may die? It's unconscionable to me. So, and I know that we've been working with the governor and the legislature. We know that they're starting to hear us. We appreciate the work of Secretary Levine and of Secretary Miller and others. But it just, you know, it's getting to the point where it's time for action, right? So if you really believe that our population is vulnerable and they're at risk, then come through with the funding, you know, and come through with what you need to do in order to make sure that these services are here for folks. Otherwise, our community system will be decimated. It'll result in higher costs for people at IDA and the state as people have to be put into nursing homes, hospitals, institutions. It's just not a pretty picture. So I just don't see the conversation at the same level I see for other folks.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, our guest during this segment of today's program, Mark Davis, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Advocacy and Resources for Autism and Intellectual Disability Provider Association, or PAR. Kathy McHale is President and CEO of SPIN, Special People in the Northeast, in Philadelphia. If you have a question or a comment, we're talking about those who are living with an intellectual disability or autism and not getting the services, the support that many of them need during this pandemic. And we're talking about the financial situation of these organizations. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, Mark, you talked about this earlier, about many people who are living with an intellectual disability or autism, having difficulty understanding why they can't go out, why they can't do the things they normally do in a routine. By the way, before I even ask that question, how important is routine? And Kathy McCann, maybe I'll ask this question to you.
Yep.
How important is routine to these people who are living with these conditions?
It is essential, and the disruption of routines has caused a great deal of emotional distress in the individuals that we support, and the support that the direct support professionals give them to explain, and you know, it really takes knowing the individuals. It takes relationships to explain and help people to understand. And what we've seen is, you know, emotional upset, behavioral upset for certain has really upticked throughout this crisis. But were it not for excellent direct support professionals, we know that it would be far worse.
Can anything be done, or is it being done remotely by video or phone calls or anything like that?
We're doing a great deal at Spin on remote work. We have our therapists, our therapeutic recreation specialists, our behavior support are all connecting remotely to the individuals that we are providing residential service to or who are home with their families, and that has helped a great deal.
But at the same time, even though you can provide support to some, you can't take someone to the bathroom via video.
Exactly.
Yeah, great point, Scott.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So in our residential services, yes, the work that is done cannot be done remotely, and it can't be done in a socially distanced manner, as Mark has said.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mark, getting back to my question before I started talking about routine, one of the real fears here was that with this population of people, as you said, 50,000 people with intellectual disabilities, autism, that 80% of them have some type of pre-existing condition, maybe more than one. One of the real fears was that they would contract COVID-19. Do you know whether that has happened throughout Pennsylvania?
Yes, it has. And there are, it has been significantly hard hit. The areas that are hardest hit it just mimics pretty much what you see in the general population. It's the southeastern Pennsylvania just getting hammered, and northeastern is as well. We've got over 9 out of 10 of the cases are in the east, southeastern, northeast. The central and the western have not been hit as hard, but they're still getting hard too. And the staff is getting hit almost 2.5 to 3 times as much as the individuals with disabilities.
Have any lost their lives?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Do you have any idea?
Folks have lost their lives.
I
can say this. I don't want to put a number on it. I mean,
I was going to say.
But I don't want to do it because the sample is so small. You know, I know we some of us know epidemiology. It's a curse, you know. But I know that the N is too small in this when we're drawing any conclusions from it. We really need a national look at how people are differentially impacted by this. But I can tell you this. There's no question in my mind from looking at even the SLIM data that we have that people with intellectual disability or autism, because 82% of them have two or more chronic conditions in addition to their IDA, which is a chronic condition, that they are at higher risk for significant complications and for passing away as well. It's stark, the difference. So, and again, I don't want to tease you with that, but the numbers aren't, as a whole, are too small. The sample size is too small, but you can see the difference in the death rate. It's significant. If folks with IDA get COVID-19, they're at a much higher risk, and we've got to do everything we can to protect them. We know that we do not have the incidence that is way off the charts like some other professions for other reasons, and I think a lot of that is because our folks have sure been settings of two or three people. Right, they're in small group homes, living environments. They're not in, most of them aren't in the larger facilities. But even with that being said, we've been fortunate that it hasn't been as widespread as I think it may have been if our folks hadn't been doing the job they're doing.
To summarize, when you said earlier that you only had cash on hand, I assume that this is an average of just a little under 3 days at this time. So what are you looking for? What are you looking for from the state?
Well, we know that the financial impact on providers in Pennsylvania is significant, right? 28% of their annual revenues is the hit we're taking. Some people don't understand. Because we are a single payer and because we are taking on this obligation of serving and protecting folks that are very vulnerable on behalf of the Commonwealth, it's a unique situation. So we don't have anywhere else to go for funding. We don't have anywhere else to go. And the folks that we serve, you know, like, we can't shut down the restaurant, right? I mean, people are going to be there, and they're going to keep coming back to us because they're relying on us for their very lives. So we're asking for funding, some of the COVID-19 relief funding from the feds. We'd like to get that to help pay for staff, to help pay for PPE, to help pay for overtime, to help pay for training. You know, we've had to shift training. The Anchor study showed that $44,000 average monthly cost related to training and onboarding in addition to what we've been paying. $77,000 average additional monthly cost related to overtime and $28,000 in monthly expenses for PPE, cleaning supplies, et cetera. These costs are real. We don't have margins to meet these. Our margins are typically 1% or less. It's very tight if we have that. And so it's just a situation right now where we're running out of staff. We're running out of access to PPE, we're running out of money, and we're running out of time. We're really asking for the legislature and the governor, particularly, to act in terms of giving us enhanced rates during the crisis, you know, to help to pay for that. We've got some folks that are living on loans right now that aren't sure how they're going to pay them back. We can't leave them hanging like that.
Mark Davis with the Pennsylvania Advocacy and Resources for Autism and Intellectual Disability Provider Association. Kathy McHale, President and CEO of SPIN in Philadelphia. Thank you for the work you're doing, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Appreciate your time, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Well, that's a tough situation, and I know that there are a lot of organizations and a lot of people who are suffering right now during this pandemic. You know, one of the things that crosses my mind is people maybe are realizing for the first time, I don't know quite how, but realizing for the first time of the kind of money and how little money those who work with people who are living with an intellectual disability or autism or working in nursing homes or long-term care homes, how little money they make. And these are people that during this pandemic are on the front lines. And you wonder whether, I mean, no one quite knows where we go economically after this, but you wonder whether there will be any long-term effects that we will treasure those people and pay them a little bit more once this ends. Where the money comes from, that's a big question. But these are important frontline people, and working with people that are saving their lives on a daily basis. Want to change gears now for our next segment of the program. Dogs, with their highly sensitive sense of smell, have been successful in sniffing out cancers, tumors, maybe even seizures in humans. Could they be trained to detect the COVID-19 virus with their noses? A new study from the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine might be able to answer that question. Researchers with Penn's Vets Working Dog Center are enlisting the help of 8 dogs, yellow, black, and chocolate Labrador retrievers, over a 3-week period to expose their sensitive noses to COVID-19 positive saliva and urine in a laboratory setting. Joining us is Dr. Cindy Otto, director of the Penn Vet Working Dog Center at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Otto, welcome to the program.
No, thanks for having me on, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Dr. Otto, tell us about the research. What exactly are you trying to determine?
So what we're trying to do here in the first phase is really a proof of concept, and that is, can dogs with their sensitive noses differentiate samples? And as you mentioned, these are samples from patients, whether it's urine or saliva, from patients with COVID-19 compared to patients without COVID-19. And what that will tell us if there's a unique odor associated with this disease.
So are we talking about someone who is actually sick from the illness, the virus, or someone who just has acquired the virus that is positive and may be asymptomatic?
So that's a great question, and we're really looking at the spectrum. We are most interested in those people that are early in the illness or asymptomatic, because that's where the application is really the most important.
Mm-hmm. So would this be almost, if it's proven or you find that dogs can sniff out the COVID-19 virus, would they be able to be used in tests? I mean, I'm picturing, and tell me if I'm right, if you're successful with this, that, you know, for right now we have people who drive up and get a swab in their nose, that a dog, they'd be able to go somewhere and a dog would be able to sniff it out.
So, Scott, that's certainly a possibility, and what we're looking at is every possible way that this information could actually advance any kind of testing. And so if there is a chemical signature, so an odor profile, then the chemists and the people that we work with developing electronic noses could actually move forward on those types of tests. But the next level would be, is it possible then for dogs to screen live humans for this disease, similar to what happens in the airports when dogs are being used to screen for explosives?
You know, I mentioned in the introduction that dogs are able to smell some types of ovarian cancer, for example, and there have been examples of them being able to sniff out when someone is about to have a seizure. What is it about their noses, their sense of smell, that they are able to do this, like in a seizure, for example, even before it happens?
It's such a wonderful mystery that we don't quite understand how they're so talented at this. But what we do know about dogs' noses is that they're so much more attuned to perceiving the world through odor. And so small changes in odor, they're able to pick that up, similar to what we would do with our sight. So we tend to look at an image. We come home and we notice that something's out of place. And that, you know, subtle difference, it alerts us. And it's kind of the same way with the dogs, that in the odor, the vision of odor, they can see if something's out of place or something's changed or different.
Give me a sense of how sensitive a dog's sense of smell is.
There are lots of different estimates about how sensitive they are, and some people say they're 1,000 times or 10,000 times more sensitive than we are. Part of that probably depends a little bit on the odor that we're talking about, but we know that they're just incredibly sensitive, and not only can they pick out the odor, but they can actually discriminate it against the background of many other odors, and I think that's what's really amazing, because that is sometimes something that our chemistry has trouble with, because there might be overlapping odors, but the dogs are able to actually pick out those individual odors.
Let's take a phone call now from Gail. Gail, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Scott. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I was wondering, we have heard of other species getting the virus, the tigers in New York and so forth. Is there any danger to these dogs of getting the disease and getting very sick?
Thank you for your call. And I know, Dr. Otto, this is a big question that many people have had. Dr. Otto?
To date, okay. We only have about 4 dogs that have been reported to have the disease. And those dogs were in environments with a heavy virus load. That said, we're paying very close attention to this. We think the risk is small, but we're going to be monitoring the dogs. And in our training phase, we're actually inactivating the virus, and not only for the dog safety, but for the human safety that are working with these samples. So we're not actually working with the live virus, but we're working with the odors from the virus and from the patient.
We have another question from a listener. It says, if the dogs are smelling urine, how do they eliminate all of the other variables that might show up in a person's output urine so they only smell COVID-19? Bottom line is, the question that the listener is asking is, how do they know the difference in the odors?
So that's another really important part of what we're doing, and why it's so important for us to have controls, which are patients' samples without COVID. So we train the dog to smell the urine sample from the positive patient, and they're smelling, you know, hundreds of different odors. But what they learn is that they only get a reward when they smell that sample. And so when we introduce a sample from a patient who doesn't have COVID, there's a lot of those other odors are going to be common across urine samples, but they don't get a reward. So they start to learn that there's something unique about the patient with COVID. And so that process and going through many, many samples so that they narrow that down and find out what's common in the COVID patients as opposed to what's not there in the normal patients or the control patients.
As you said, there's precedent for this with other medical conditions, but I'm curious, like in the example of ovarian cancer, how does a dog, okay, now when I say how, maybe that's not the right word, but in what setting, what's the process for a canine detecting someone who has ovarian cancer?
So ovarian cancer is going to be very different from what we're imagining with COVID. And we've been working with ovarian cancer now for about 6.5 years. And for us, that process is a blood sample sent to our laboratory where the dogs screen that sample. But the goal of that is to actually develop an electronic sensing device for mass screening that would happen in a laboratory setting. And so that's very different than what we would consider one of the possible outcomes with the dogs for COVID, because what we're dealing with COVID is a huge population of people that need to be screened in a relatively short period of time. And so that's where we're thinking of translating that. Again, with the ovarian cancer, any of our cancer detection, we would not conceive of taking the dogs to screen live humans. But with COVID, that definitely is something that we're considering.
So we may, if this research is successful and we find the dogs can do this, that other than just bomb-sniffing dogs, we may find COVID-sniffing dogs. Could you foresee the day, if this is successful, that we would have dogs sniffing people at airports or, you know, those where people coming from other countries or other states would be?
Absolutely. That's certainly one of our visions, and there's a lot of steps before we can get there. And we really need to think about this from the best scientific aspect, the safety aspects, and then the practicality of how do we implement this, because it's going to take a lot of dogs who are going to be very specially trained, and it takes a very special dog to be able to do this level of discrimination. This is really tough work for them to be able to, you know, differentiate between normals and the patients, especially when we're talking about in a public setting like that. So it's our goal to anticipate that, but we definitely want to make sure that we have all of the scientific evidence to support that it will work and that it's safe.
We have an email here from John who says, if a dog has previously been trained to detect something specific, would they then be able to learn a new scent in such a way that they don't react to anything other than the new scent?
That's a great question, and I'm glad he put and they don't react to anything other than the new scent, because they have such wonderful memories. So if we had an explosive detection dog and we decided we wanted to go ahead and train them on COVID, the problem we would have is if they alerted, we wouldn't know if that was to an explosive or to COVID. And so the risk of doing that is not worth it. So, you know, there may be other dogs that we would be, you know, consider retraining, but they would still always have that odor memory. And so it would have to be something that would not be likely to be showing up, you know, in an airport, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. So how long do you anticipate this research taking?
So I think there's a couple of stages. And as you mentioned, you know, once we introduce the dogs to the samples, and we're hoping to do that, you know, maybe at the end of this week, but more likely next week, that'll take us about 3 to 4 weeks to know if there's a specific odor. Once we've got that, then again, our chemists and the electronic nose development folks can go ahead and start working on that aspect of it. But then we'll work on trying to determine if the dogs are able to detect this odor in live humans and in more of that practical setting. Then there's also the question of all of the science behind it, trying to figure out, you know, what is this odor and what are the factors that make a dog better or create a challenge for the dogs. So many different stages. The first stage, probably, 3 to 4 weeks. Second stage, probably 3 to 4 months. To get them operational, we're probably talking 6 to 8, maybe to 12 months. And to answer all of the research questions, that could be a lifetime, but we'll probably get a lot of them in a year to a year and a half.
Is it too soon to ask whether you've seen any progress at all?
So it is. We do have the dogs in training. The dogs are doing great in training, learning the mechanics of how they're going to be testing these samples. But we have just got the official approvals, and all checked all the safety boxes for getting these samples. We're working with our colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia to get these samples so that we can train the dogs. I think we're encouraged just based on what dogs have done in the past, but we don't have any data yet, but we're looking forward to it.
I think there are a lot of people probably who would like to see that. Rather than getting that nasal swab that I understand is not very comfortable, but Dr. Cindy Otto, director of Penn Vet Working Dog Center at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine, thank you very much for what you're doing.
Well, thank you for having me, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Life has changed a great deal for many Americans during the COVID-19 pandemic. Social distancing means no handshakes or hugs. But one of the most significant changes is almost everyone is wearing a face mask. It's not something we're used to, and sometimes they're not very comfortable. So what is the correct way to wear a face mask? Joining us is Nicole Jokum, a medical student at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University and co-creator of So Face Mask Philadelphia. Ms. Jokum, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so here's the big question. What's the correct way to wear a face mask?
Sure, that's a bit of a loaded question.
It is.
But I think there's a few things, simple, basic things you want to keep in mind. One is the fabric, so just having something that's 100% cotton and not synthetic. And then just to wear one, you always want to have it cover your nose and your mouth. I think some of us have maybe, on our once-a-week trip to the grocery stores have seen people maybe just with it on their mouth or pulled down, but you always want to keep it over both the nose and the mouth. And then the other thing is just the not tight, but the snug fit across, around the mouth and the nose is really important. That's where some of the efficacy of wearing a face mask comes in. So just like a good fit is really important. Maybe you'll have to try on a couple different models. There's different shapes, and maybe people will just have to try a few different ones until they find the one that fits for them, fits the best for them.
I've seen people who are maybe wearing a handkerchief around their face. I mean, is that as good as a tight-fitting face mask, cotton face mask?
Sure. So I think that a properly form-fitted but not too tight face mask is the better choice than, a handkerchief or whatnot. Just because, for example, I live in Philadelphia, and I see a lot of people wearing handkerchiefs, and it's much more loose. The air flows in, so I kind of use I think more like a sneeze test. If the person wearing it were to have like a really strong sneeze or cough, where could the escape points be? And I think with a handkerchief, there's just more escape points. So a form-fitted face mask, always preferable But of course, handkerchief, if that's your only option, that's appropriate too, per the CDC and other state guidelines.
Why cotton rather than a synthetic material?
Sure, yeah. So something we've been looking in since the beginning. In general, it's more breathable. It holds up to high heat. Repeated washings, there's been a lot of research done on cotton just because it's used so widely. Synthetic fibers, spandex, polyester, also flannel is not synthetic, but it's cotton that has that kind of soft coating. It can retain moisture. There's been research studies that even show that spandex can even retain virus particles longer, too.
Well, see, that brings up a point. How long can someone, how many days in a row, how many hours can someone wear a face mask before it's no good to them anymore? It becomes contaminated or they need it, it has to be washed?
Sure. That's a fantastic question. And I think, for example, I'm a medical student. We wear disposable face masks in the hospital and operating room procedures, and you always change it after every use. So if you were to kind of, wear a face mask, see one patient, you would discard it. Of course, times are different. Things are scarce. And in terms of reusable ones, I still think it's the same. I think everyone, if you can have a small set, and if you go to the grocery store and wear a face mask, throw it in a laundry basket. And then if you go out later that evening, and, I know many people aren't doing multiple errands, but if you find yourself doing that, I think you have to put on a new one and just kind of wash after every use, if you can. That's not feasible for everyone. They don't have multiple. But if you can, I think that's the goal to work up toward over the course of a year.
If you're just joining us, we only have a few minutes left in the program, and I know there are a lot of people out there who have had questions about face masks. Our guest is Nicole Yoakum, a medical student at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University and co-creator of So Face Mask Philadelphia. If you have a question, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Ms. Yoakum, here's the big question. For the 60% of the population like me who wears glasses, one of the things that I noticed from the very, very beginning, I'm sure all those who wear glasses notice the same thing. Our glasses keep fogging up. How do we keep our glasses from fogging up?
Yeah, I think that's the maybe billion-dollar question. Whoever solves that will be a very rich person one day. But, I think there's little things that you can do. A form-fitting area around the nose is really useful. So some masks come with either a removable slot or built-in like a metal nose piece that's flexible that you can kind of form-fit around your nose, just like the disposable ones have. Temperature always also plays a big role. So if you're in a warm environment, the glasses tend to fog up more. I've heard other anecdotal things about washing like the glasses lens in soapy water. I have not tested that out personally or know people that do that, but I've kind of read that in my own research. And then one thing I personally do is I tip my glasses forward ever so slightly. I wear glasses myself, not enough to where it would change the kind of the vision in my lenses, but it kind of creates a little bit more airflow between more like my eyebrows and the glasses. And that, when I'm in the operating room myself as a medical student, that's what I do, and it works pretty well for me.
I've also heard, one of the many of the suggestions that you just had, I've heard, washing the glasses ahead of time with soapy water, that kind of thing. But one is folding the top of the mask over or under, I guess you would say, that catches some of the air going up and keeps it from getting to the glasses. Have you heard that one?
Sure. I haven't heard that one specifically, but I heard a very similar one where people will take a tissue and fold it into like a thin strip and use it as a thing. To my knowledge and research so far, completely fine. But I would just caution people to remember to, use a new tissue every time. And as soon as it gets a little bit like damp, especially with summer coming, just be prepared to swap it out a lot and don't kind of use the same one over and over again. But I think anything that helps create that seal will help the breath from, keep the breath from going up to the glasses.
Is summer coming? Do you know something we don't?
We'll see. It'll take day by day, all of us.
I guess it's supposed to be a little bit warmer over the next few days, but, I mean, we haven't seen even a springtime yet. I have a question here from listener Matt. Says, how about a cut-off T-shirt sleeve? They fit tightly and are easy to make. Is this acceptable?
Oh, that's a great question. I haven't thought about that one specifically. On a side point, we found that cut-off T-shirt sleeves that people are discarding are making great kind of pockets. So it's like people, if they take their face mask off, they want somewhere to store it that's not, you know, plastic or usable. People are using sleeves for that. Just in terms of cotton in general, a lot of T-shirts are cotton polyester blends. We tend to recommend against that if possible. But if it's 100% cotton, we always recommend a double layer if possible. You know, technically, you know, that would work.
We have another question from a listener. What about wearing a mask while exercising? Any suggestions there?
Oh, boy. Yeah, though I think this is one of the current timely questions that I see everywhere today. You know, local friends, major news outlets everywhere. And I think that to be decided, but I think that people, of course, if they have any trouble breathing at all, they should be very cautious against wearing a mask, especially people that are asthmatics and things like this and other breathing issues. If you're kind of doing cardiovascular exercise outside during allergy season with a mask on, you know, just be careful, discuss with your doctor, things like that. But unfortunately, I think that the verdict will be out on kind of running in masks. I think a lot of people are looking into that no more soon.
Let's take a phone call from Sue. Sue, you're on the air. Hello, Sue? Or was this just a comment? No, she's on the line. Is Sue there? Well, she had a question, and I can pass this along. She wanted to know if it was a legitimate excuse to not be in the workplace when coworker isn't wearing a mask that you're closely working with. I mean, I think she means if you're closely working with someone and they're not wearing a mask, does that give you reason to say, listen, I don't want to work next near this person or in this workplace?
Sure.
I think these are things.
That's a fantastic question.
It really is. Go ahead.
Just with things, you know, reopening, and I'm kind of following the Pennsylvania Mass Daily, I think that I've had with my own immediate family, my parents mentioned this to me about their own workplaces and siblings and whatnot. I think that's a fantastic question. I think it's a very valid concern to have, discuss with the management and your coworkers, for sure. And I think that will also be something that will be more and more relevant and timely as things reopen and workplaces reopen. There'll be a lot of conversations had about this for sure.
You know, I'm curious, Nicole, do you see this going beyond just the next few months or so? I mean, will there be people waking up Christmas morning under the Christmas tree and find a mask for gifts?
Sure. I think that face masks are a positive thing. I've been lucky enough to travel a bit around the world, and you know, I kind of noticed on maybe like one trip to Hong Kong, it was this summer, and you know, a lot of people had face masks. It just integrated into normal culture where if you were sick, you wear a face mask. So if it is longer, I think that we can shift our perspective on it to more of a very slow, positive changing of culture where if you're sick, coughing, sneezing, you know, maybe, you know, we do wear these on the long term, of course, to a different degree. But I think that would definitely be a good thing. And, you know, of course, we have many other infectious respiratory illnesses every day. So it would help for all of those, not just COVID as well.
We only have a minute or so left, Nicole. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. How does one become an expert on wearing a face mask?
Oh, sure. That's a very good question, too. You just have an interest and keep reading about it, and people can always connect with us as well. If they look us up online, they can join our Facebook group or visit our website or shoot us an email, and we always respond to every message we receive, and we'd love to answer any questions that people send our way, for sure.
What is your Facebook page or your website?
Sure. So the website is www.sewfacemasks, SoFaceMass.org. And if on a Facebook search bar, if you just search SoFaceMass Philadelphia, it will come up. But of course, the website will link to anything. And again, if people even, you know, private message us any question, we'd be happy to steer them in the way of the best resources we found. Of course, we don't come up with anything on our own. We kind of follow the guidance set out and try to bring
Nicole
it all together for people to digest.
No, Nicole Yocum, thank you very much for being with us
today.
Thank
you.